Good morning to everyone, and thank you so much for being here. I will start off by doing something we don't do when we are in Lincoln, Nebraska, and that is I will introduce the court. I am Mike Havikin, and I am the Chief Justice, and to my immediate right is Justice John Wright from Scott's Bluff. And to his right is Justice William Castle of O'Neill. And to his right is Justice Max Kelch of Papillion. To my immediate left is Justice Lindsay Miller Lerman of Omaha. And to her left is Justice Stephanie Stacy of Lincoln. And to her left is Justice Jeff Funk of Nebraska City. And with those introductions, we will begin with today's cases. Our first case of the day is State versus Rosario Betancourt Garcia. Mr. Alban and Mr. Ralph, you may take your places. And Mr. Alban, good morning to you. You may proceed, approach the podium, and then you may proceed.
May it please the court, my name is Mark Alban. I am the attorney for the appellant, Rosario Betancourt Garcia. On November 17th, 2003, a two-count complaint was filed in Madison County Court. It was against Mr. Betancourt, alleging count one, kidnapping, and count two, use of a weapon to commit a felony. At that time, an affidavit and a warrant for arrest was also issued. It stemmed from some incidents a couple days earlier where the victim, I'll say Jesus, was approached by a friend, Trevino, and made a request to help fix a car. Trevino then took the victim out in the country where they allegedly met Betancourt, and at that point it's alleged that Betancourt threatened the victim. And the victim was subsequently, by Trevino and Betancourt, alleged he was bound, gagged, and he was tied up. Then he was taken back into the community of Madison, where that's where he had been. They were out in the country. They brought him back, placed the victim in a shed, wasn't locked or anything, but he was bound, left him on the floor, and he left. Subsequently, the victim got up and hopped out and was found by the public and law enforcement. There was, at that time, a search done of the area to try to find out if Trevino or Betancourt was in the area. They were not found in the area. Go forward to May 7 of 2004. May 7 of 2004, Betancourt was residing, living in Collin County, Texas, which is Plano, Texas, northeast Dallas area. He was stopped on a routine traffic stop. At that time, he was informed, as he testified at trial for the first time, that there was a warrant for his arrest. He was
Counsel, excuse me. For purposes of this argument, you would concede that when Betancourt could not be found at the outset, that he was or could be deemed to have been fleeing from justice within the meaning of the statute.
He could have been deemed, I would agree, at that point.
At that point. Your argument point, actually turns on later events, correct?
Primarily, yes, it does. In fact, the brief focuses on the fact that what happened next was on May 11th, 2004, when Betancourt, after he was arrested on the 7th, taken to court on the 11th, he signed a waiver of extradition. Signed it in open court, said, here I am, come and get me, I want to take care of this.
This is in Texas, court in Texas.
This is at a Collin, it wasn't, I think, Collin County, but it was in Texas. So thank you very much.
Counsel, in relation to May 7th, 2004, how quickly was he deported?
That fact we honestly do not have. The record is absent of that. That specific fact we don't know. We know that on the 17th, the Madison County Sheriff's Office dispatched officers or a transport to pick up Betancourt in Texas. And what the record shows is that at some point they were informed that Betancourt was, quote, turned over, given to, designated as INS. The record that is stipulated says that Madison County Sheriff's Office said, forget it, come home, and nothing further was done.
Didn't your client testify that he was immediately deported, even though there was no specific...
I don't believe it was... I don't know, recall if he said the term was immediately, but we don't know whether immediately, whether it was a week, a day, or a month. Honestly, that is absent. And that goes to part of the main point of my argument is when he signed that waiver of extradition, he said to come and get me. It took 6 days for Madison to make arrangements. They then get a notice. They don't have him. We don't know. And that's part of... What I'm submitting to you, Your Honors, is that Betancourt said on May 11th, I'm here, come and get me. And then, at some point, nobody gets him.
Excuse me, translate that. What is the legal significance of the come and get me?
What's legal is that he received notice at that time that he was wanted, so he was availing himself to the authorities of the state of Nebraska. What is also significant at that time is that on or about on or about May, and the record's a little unclear on this, but May 11th, 2004, the Madison County Sheriff's Office or authorities took Betancourt off the active warrant list. He was not in the state of Nebraska. He was never back here in the state of Nebraska, but his name was taken off as an active warrant. That was not put back on until May 25th. Was Betancourt in the state of Texas? I don't know. He may have been. Was he with INS? Was he in Collin County Jail?
So are you making a constitutional argument of some kind?
What we are doing, well, what was dealt with, I guess it gets, I want to make the constitutional argument, excuse my throat. The constitutional argument was raised when the initial trial counsel filed a motion for absolute discharge on the speedy trial issue. Unfortunately, not that it was overruled by trial court at that time, it was submitted to appeal, and for some reason trial counsel withdrew the appeal. And so that issue was taken away from Betancourt to go forward on that constitutional issue of speedy trial. However, I will submit that it was still brought up when there was a motion for a directed verdict at the trial. So it's a combination of the speedy trial and the statute of limitations that we're dealing with here, especially when it comes to count three. Count three, which is a conspiracy, we're alleging that the statute of limitations, it was clearly beyond, because the focus, again, is May 11 of 2004, because at that time, we're submitting, and I submit that what Madison County didn't do, there was really nothing else that was done, and we don't have any record of anything else. Should they have done something? Yes. He was available to be picked up, and I would submit a reason.
Counsel, once he's in federal custody, and they what exactly should be in Mexico, there's no authority.
I would agree. However, the record does not say that he was in federal authority. We have the suggestion that from Collin County that he was, but there was never anything verified, nothing followed up by Madison County Sheriff's Office to say where was he. They wanted him. The record is conspicuously absent and void of that information because we don't know, and so that gets into a little bit of a conjecture, at least on my part. We don't know that he was, in fact, in the custody. They said he was turned over, but if they had gone forward and gone down there, they would have... Yes, we get into the conjecture, likely found that he was still in Collin County Jail. Yes, he was. Subsequently, we just don't know how soon or how late that came. Whether it immediately was a week or 10 days or a month, that we don't know. And that's where we're submitting that something should be in the record saying what, in fact, was done. Because Betancourt, when he was arrested, was given notice there was a warrant. And then when he signed the waiver of extradition, he said, here I am, come and get me. His arrest warrant is pulled off the teletype, is what it's called. So the average person, I would submit, would think, they don't want me, there's not a warrant, and then he's deported.
So in plainer terms, he's not fleeing anywhere?
That would be correct. That is that's the crux of the issue, is whether or not he is fleeing from justice.
I'd like to ask you a question about the interpretation of the statute of limitations, 29-110, subsection 9, that provides the time limitations prescribed in this section shall not extend to any person fleeing from justice. That's all it says, correct?
Correct.
Once someone is deemed to have fled from justice, isn't a logical reading of the statute that the time limit of the statute of limitations simply never applies again to that individual?
I wouldn't say never again. I don't agree with that. But the trial court did overrule the motion, perhaps to discharge, also overruled the motion to quash. But in dealing with the fleeing from justice, as it's generally been understood in relation to the statute of limitations, means to leave one's usual place of abode or the jurisdiction where an offense has been committed with the intent to avoid detection or prosecution for some public offense. When Betancourt was picked up, he received notice. He waived his extradition and said, here I am. That May 11th is key to everything here, that at that point,
counsel,
he was not
saying it's key because the waiver of extradition stopped the tolling? Is that your argument?
Yes, he made himself available. Yes. He made himself available, and they did not get him. And what's interesting, and when you couple it with the fact that they took him off of the active warrant list, was that appropriate? It told him, and it told everyone else, they didn't want him. What would a reasonable person do if you give him a presumption of innocence? It would be that they don't want me, and so therefore, it should not toll the statute of limitations.
Do we have any case authority which has ever interpreted the statute of limitations exception that we're talking about, that talks about terminating a time of fleeing from justice?
I don't have anything. Are you talking about a gap of time, or?
Well, I'm just, in terms of section 29-110 sub 9, has this court or any other Nebraska court, to your knowledge, spoken to the issue of can that be terminated, that fleeing from justice terminated by some act of the defendant?
Well, by the act of the defendant, well, clearly, if they're attempting to turn themselves in as one, for example, if the state, and the cases I've cited would submit, if the state clearly knew where the defendant was, that, quite frankly, doesn't apply that they necessarily knew that he was in Texas, although he did live openly and notoriously there for 10 years. So there is not something specifically that says what you're asking in that case, but it can be told by those things. And when the state fails to act and get him, that's where I cited many cases that suggest that the state has at least some due diligence, some reasonable diligence, to make an effort to get the prisoner that you want. And if they don't do it, then that act should not go against the defendant.
Under your view of the statute, you can be fleeing and then not fleeing, and then there's a passage of time, and you can start up fleeing again, and someone's got to keep a calendar?
I'm not saying that. What was the significant date was when he received notice, and then on the May 11th when he said, here, he wasn't fleeing when he signed that waiver of extradition. He said, here I am, come get me. They take him off of a warrant so that people would think, and he would think, I'm not wanted, and then subsequently deported. So that is the key date. And all these cases.
Is there evidence in our record that suggests he knew that warrant was pulled?
No, we don't have that. We do not have that specific information in there. I don't believe the record talks to that. But it is a fact that it's there. Just like what's not in the record is so much of even any inquiry as to was he really with INS? Did they go all the way down there? Do we have any documentation that he was in fact received by INS or anything of that nature? Just that he was given notice that that was what happened.
And counsel, he was still in custody after the waiver of extradition on May 11th. Is that correct?
Yes.
And he stayed in custody until he was deported by INS. Is
that whenever
correct?
That was, correct.
And the new warrant was put back on in May 24th?
May 25th, 8 days after the attempt by Madison County to pick him up.
Was he ever made aware of that?
That was not in the record. We do not have that in the record, that he was specifically made aware of that. The only thing I can presume is that, I guess, presumptions, they took him off. And so we know that he was made aware of the charges because he signed the waiver rather quickly, rather promptly, saying, oh my goodness, here I am, come take me. That, and not that it relates that way, but when he was picked up a second time, he did the same thing very promptly and expeditiously.
Isn't your due diligence argument a speedy trial argument?
Would you state that one more time, Your Honor?
It doesn't due diligence relate to speedy trial and not to the statute of limitations?
It does relate to the speedy trial. You are correct. You are correct in that sense. But I would submit that it, as the statute of limitations is applied, it does come into both of them a bit. The statute, or the speedy trial, obviously is a constitutional issue and the stronger issue that we like to, unfortunately don't have directly before the court. And so I'm submitting to you on the statute of limitations, it's effectively, everything's kind of woven together. And so with that, these cases
How would we weave that together, well, if we were to side with you in this case?
If, for example, the court was to decide that the motion for directed verdict should have been granted because the court was wrong in overruling that motion for absolute discharge, in finding this, basically on those same facts, that when Betancourt was notified in 2004, on that May 11th day, it started, his speedy trial started to run, because on those two counts that had been filed, it should have started to run at that point in time. And they didn't pick him up, so the state did not make efforts at that point. And naturally, it's very fact-sensitive. That's referenced in these cases, that each case is usually very unique as to the circumstances in its own respective case. And so those are the two issues I want. The ineffective assistance of counsel and those other things have been set forth in the brief, but it comes down to that point in time as to the motion to quash, also as to the speedy trial, when you basically use a nexus and connect it back to the motion for absolute discharge. And so with that, Betancourt, I submit that this court can look at what Betancourt did, and he did what any average person would do. He availed himself, and I would submit that this court can correct that wrong, and this court should correct that wrong, and I would ask the court to reverse and remand accordingly. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Ralph, good morning to you.
May it please the court, my name is Austin Ralph. I represent the state of Nebraska. Betancourt Garcia argues, one, that the court erred in overruling his motion to quash, two, that the evidence was insufficient to support the jury's finding that he was fleeing from justice so as to toll the statute of limitations, and three, that the court erred in failing to find the necessary mitigating facts to reduce the kidnapping from a Class 1A to a Class 2 felony. He also argues ineffective assistance of counsel. I will address each error in detail here in a moment, but in short, our position is that his arguments are without merit. We would point out that in our view there is plain error in the sentencing and the classification of the conspiracy charge. We'd ask this court to correct it and then to affirm as modified.
I beg your pardon. What is the appropriate relief? What's the authority of this court to deal with that error, do you think?
Well, this court, I think, in past cases has, I don't want to say routinely, but often addressed what you have considered plain error in sentencing. I think it would be appropriate here, considering that conspiracy by law is the same classification as the most severe offense that is the object of the conspiracy. In this case, that's a Class 1A kidnapping. Conspiracy should also be a Class 1A, which comes with a mandatory life sentence. So I would ask this court to correct that under the plain error doctrine. I do think it is something worth correcting, considering that the statute very clearly lays out the classification and sentence. Moving to the
counsel, opposing counsel argues that taking the warrant off around May 11th, vacating the warrant, or not vacating, but taking it off the National Registry, and then waiting to put it back on until May 25th shows lack of due diligence by the state. What's your...
I would disagree. I think the state, basically from the time that the incident occurred, November 15th, 2003, up to finding him in Texas, I think the record sufficiently shows that they were pursuing Mr. Betancourt Garcia actively. They then, got the transportation set up a few days after the waiver of extradition, and then, as opposing counsel said, the record is not entirely clear on how quickly he was extradited, but he was turned over to INS on May 17th, 2004, and I think he testified basically that happened immediately, fairly recently, and then he just came back to Texas a few months later. So this all happened very quickly. I think the state actively pursued him up until the point he was extradited. After that, we're not entirely sure, the exact time frame, but I would say that the state did everything it could to find Mr. Betancourt Garcia and bring him back to be prosecuted.
Under 29110, can you have a defendant who is fleeing and then not fleeing and then, I'm working
sure.
on a continuum and fleeing yet again and...
Oh, right, and Justice Castle, had that question about the exact language in sub 10, and I didn't research it perhaps as thoroughly as I should have, but when I was reviewing federal courts as well as an ALR, they all suggested or held that once the fleeing from justice stops, that the statute of limitations is basically start over. So that at least was my impression from the federal courts that I reviewed, and so I did not pursue it too heavily here, particularly when the Nebraska Supreme Court cases, I feel like, speaks in terms of tolling statute of limitations rather than terminating, and so I would suggest, or I think my position would be that once the fleeing from justice stops, it seems the rational thing would be that the statute of limitations would then start over and start running again.
So then, thus, the key question becomes, when does the fleeing from justice stop? And in particular, when did it stop in the state's view under these facts?
Well, I guess I would quibble a little bit in that I think the key question would be when does it restart in our view, because I don't think that there's any dispute that he did a waiver of extradition on May 11th, based on my research, that would be terminating. He's no longer fleeing from justice at that point. But when he is mistakenly released to INS, and there's no dispute in the record that it was a mistake, it was an error on the part of the Texas authorities, and then he is subsequently deported and then returns back to Texas, it's our view that he is, in effect, fleeing from justice again. And I base that on in my brief, based on the Second Circuit opinion in U.S. versus Catino, which basically said that when you're aware of the charges and you're aware you're being looked for, you have a duty to surrender yourself to the authorities, and he did not. It's very clear from the record that he was aware of the charges because he was told about the arrest warrant.
Would he
initially
not have stayed in Mexico?
Well, he testified that he would have, but we're under, I think, a sufficiency standard of review here, and the jury rejected that, and I think it was their prerogative to do that. Our standard of review is very deferential, and so their finding, I think, again, much like sufficiency of any other element of the crime, we just ask, is there evidence to support it, and I think there is.
Well, these were all choices made by the defendant. When he was deported to Mexico, he made the choice to come back.
Yes, he did.
And at the time he came back, then he was under a duty to turn himself in if the statute of limitations were to apply.
That's our position, is that if you're aware of the charges, you have the duty to surrender yourself to the prosecuting authorities to do everything in your power to do that. Otherwise, you're effectively fleeing from justice.
So the warrant was reissued on the 25th, but he was deported on the 17th.
Well,
what is his duty? Does he have to go to the courthouse and say, I'm back in the country illegally, here I am, is there a warrant for me? What is his duty?
Well, basically, yes. I would say as well that the warrant was never reissued for my review of the record. The warrant was always there. It was just put back onto the teletype system by the police officers. So the warrant existed from the time it was issued November 17th all the way up to basically when he's brought back in 2013. It was always there.
When did the defendant know there was a warrant outstanding for his arrest?
Well, when he was arrested on May 7th, and then he's told, I don't recall exactly or exactly how, but he was told about these charges that were transmitted to him, or he was notified of them, he knew of them, and then he was mistakenly deported by INS.
And he'd been stopped by for a traffic violation, is that correct, on May 7th?
Yes.
So being held from May 7th till May 17th was on the warrant, the active warrant for Madison County, is that correct?
What does warrant withdrawn mean, or active warrant, or what are the kinds of warrants, and what do they mean?
My understanding is that there's some sort of teletype system that notifies other law enforcement agencies that this man is wanted, and so when it was quote-unquote withdrawn, they did that. They just took it off the system because he was in custody, and then when they found out he'd been deported, they put it back on the system on May 25th, you know, in the case that, as happened, he came back, and they eventually did find him on that same warrant.
So no judicial officer vacated or recalled that warrant?
Not that I'm aware of, no. I believe it's the same warrant, again, from that was issued November 17th, 2003, all the way through the same through the proceedings in 2013. I did want to emphasize, too, on the motion to quash and the fleeing from justice issue, that everything here is directed at the conspiracy charge. And the motion to quash very clearly is based on the statute of limitations, which pertains only to the conspiracy charge, because 29-110 sub 1 very clearly says that the statute of limitations will basically is told once you have a complaint and you have an arrest warrant. Well, so on counts 1 and 2, the complaint and arrest warrant came out just a few days after the incident. So the statute of limitations has no effect on those two counts. We're talking about conspiracy only. And with regard to the motion to quash, it's our position the district court properly overruled that because the fleeing from justice issue is a question for the jury. I think that's established in our case law back to 1940. So it's not something that should be disposed of preliminarily or before the jury gets a handle on it as a matter of law. So the court properly overruled that motion to quash. On the sufficiency of the fleeing from justice issue, again, emphasize that it's only the conspiracy charge at issue. I think that's best evidenced by the actual jury instructions, which contains an instruction to the jury to deal with it preliminarily, this fleeing from justice issue, before actually going to the elements of the crime. The attorneys at trial both recognized that it is only relevant to the conspiracy charge. And the reason I'm emphasizing this is because the conspiracy charge was concurrent to the kidnapping, which is a life in prison. And it's our position, as I said before, that the fleeing from justice, while he was no longer fleeing from the May 11th to when he comes back to Texas, after that point, he's effectively fleeing from justice again, which allows the conspiracy charge to be added within the statute of limitations. The ineffective assistance of counsel, the first claim regarding the court's motion to, or denial of the motion to discharge, it's our position that may be addressed on direct appeal. My review of the order basically shows that it's correct, and presumably that's why he dismissed the appeal, because it was meritless. So I think we can get rid of that assigned error. The second claim on ineffective assistance of counsel is relating to his attorney's failure to properly prepare his alibi defense to get these witnesses apparently ready. That was not assigned in the brief, so we would submit it's not preserved for appellate review. Additionally, we would say that even if this looks past that problem, that it's insufficiently alleged because we don't know what witnesses or what testimony he's talking about. Finally, with the district court's finding on the or failure to find the mitigating facts to reduce the kidnapping from Class 1A to Class 2, we submit that the standard review is for clear error and that there was no clear error in the court's findings. I think if you look at the Supplemental Bill of Exceptions, pages 20 to 23, it lays out all the court's reasons for why this was a 1A, basically that he, Betancourt Garcia, did not voluntarily release Pedro Jesus, and so the mitigating factors were not present. And then finally, again, the plain error issue that we see with the classification of the conspiracy charge, we submit that that should be a 1A mandatory life in prison.
If the issue that you were talking about, the level of the offense or the mitigation, if the victim had not been bound but simply had been left in the shed, would the answer be different?
No, I don't think so, and here's why. Because when he's left in the shed, it's dark, cold out, he has no coat, this is November. He doesn't know, for example, it's two people that kidnapped him. He doesn't know if somebody's been left to watch outside while he's leaving. He doesn't know you know, where he is necessarily. Well, I take that back. He did know that he was at Betancourt Garcia's house, but he doesn't know if there's anybody else around that he can run to. He just happened to, as the court, district court said, you know, through his own ingenuity and basically panic, was able to escape on his own accord. So even if he wasn't bound, I don't think there's an intent to release him voluntarily or without harm, because Betancourt Garcia said, I'm going to get your brother and we're going to come back and I'm going to shoot both of you. So the binding, while a factor, I don't think would change the result in this case.
And the record supports that they did come back.
They did. They did come back. They just happened to see that there was a bunch of cops at that point, and so they decided to flee. His co-defendants or co-conspirators' testimony indicated that the defendant, Mr. Betancourt Garcia, actually wanted to go back in and try and get Pedro from the cops. He convinced him to basically, let's get out of here. And so there was no intent, I think, to release him voluntarily, which is what they would have had to have found to reduce it to a Class 2 felony. Unless there are any further questions, we would submit it. We'd ask this court to affirm the judgment as modified.
I have a question.
Yes, Chief Justice.
The classification of felonies, what is the ramification of that mistake? Can we simply change it, or does he have to be resentenced? Or what are the ramifications of that?
Well, I think you can. It's not a situation where, say, it was a plea deal or something where the nature of the charges or the exact penalties would have affected some decision that he made. He went forward on a trial. He was found guilty. As a matter of law, it is a Class 1A, and that is mandatory life, so there's no need to remand for further sentencing proceedings. It's just correcting an obvious legal mistake, I think, and something that this court can do.
Counsel, at his arraignment, what was the defendant told with respect to the possible penalties for Count 3?
Well, I think it's in the county court transcript, and I assume that he was arraigned on a Class 2. I don't recall offhand. But again, I don't think that changed. It did not change any decision that he made. There was no plea agreement. There was no plea deal. He didn't offer a plea. He's tried, found guilty. It's just correcting a legal mistake that I think this court can do under the plain error doctrine.
So, counsel, since he was the amended information incorrectly charged him, and at arraignment he was given the wrong penalty, that doesn't change anything here, you don't think?
I don't think so. I don't think so. If it was a plea situation, I think it'd be a lot different. But here, where he's had a trial, there's no question as to his guilt, and it's simply correcting a legal mistake that didn't affect any decision that he made. I guess I don't see an issue with it, but I'll leave that to this court to decide.
In the endorsement of the penalty on the information, is that endorsement considered part of the charge, or is it something separate?
I think it's something separate. I think the charge is basically the language of the statute, the factual circumstances. I think the sentence would be separate from the charge, or the classification would be separate from the charge. Unless there are any further questions, we'd ask you to affirm as modified. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have time for rebuttal?
There is 3 minutes and 54 seconds.
3 minutes and 54 seconds, Mr. Albin.
Again, we've made some assumptions as to what is in the record when we get back to that May 11th date. And the record is what it is. And so I'm again submitting that we shouldn't try to speculate when things happened. All we have is what that record is, and it is minimalistic with regard to that time period from May 7th to May 17th and then the 25th. It was also suggested that he was deported on the 17th. We don't know. We know that there's different times on even the teletype. I think it is teletype. And some of the testimony said May 11th, then it was a little buried. Bottom line is he had notice. He gave himself availability to Addison, and so we're submitting that he did what he had to do, and he did what a reasonable person would do in his situation. He availed himself to Nebraska, and they failed to act as they should have, and so with that, we would submit it for a proper decision.
He never did surrender to the court in Madison County.
No, he did not. But as you have asked questions of the AG's office, reasonably, I think he did what any reasonable person would do. He lived, he just going about his life, and he had availed himself and didn't know that there was anything else further out there. So that's why we think that the statute should not have told. And with that, it's very sensitive, but Betancourt did what anybody would do. He availed himself. And so with that, we would submit what's in my brief to the court on the other issues. Nothing further needs to be said. Thank you.
Mr. Albin, could you weigh in on the ramifications of the misclassification of the conspiracy charge?
Well, first off, I disagree with the Attorney General's office. There, it was clear error. I think there was no appeal of that issue by them. I've submitted in my brief that I think it would be a miscarriage of justice to go there, at least the way this case has been presented. Also, the classification as it was, my initial look at it was a Class 1A, it's a Class 1 felony, and as such, I think the prosecutor was looking at it from that perspective. Class 1 is a Class 1, Class 1A is a Class 1, a Class 1B is a Class 1. But I would submit that as it was charged and as the facts were and Judge Castle brought out, that it would not warrant this court delving into that issue. I just think that there isn't a proper method to do it. And other, they're just saying plain error, let's go ahead and do it. I would think that that's not where the court should go, and I don't think the court has authority to do so. Submitted on that. With that, we would submit that the evidence would suggest that the case should be reversed and remanded accordingly in favor of Betancourt. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. The court has a little homework for both of you in regard to that misclassification issue, and I'm going to read you the order that you will both get either electronically or hard copy or both. On the court's own motion, the parties are ordered to submit simultaneous supplemental briefs addressing the following question. Assuming this court grants the state's request to find that the district court plainly erred in its classification of and sentence for the defendant's conviction of conspiracy to commit kidnapping, a Class 1A felony, what is the appropriate remedy? The parties' simultaneous supplemental briefs shall answer this question and are due 14 days from the date of this order, which will be today. The supplemental briefs shall not exceed 15 pages in length. Do you have any questions about that? Okay, thank you very much. On we go then to the next case of the day, which is